the last thing we have is a little thank you for our speakers. I know they're not done yet, but we'll give it to you now. Dr. Bob had a little prayer on his desk. It's the humility one, and we framed it for you, and we'll mail it to you guys. There's one for each of you. Sheldon. I can't see anymore. This is on Dr. Bob's desk. It's in Dr. Bob and the Good Old Timers if you want to read about it. But
this is very beautiful. Thank you, everybody, for this. It's very, very nice. It says humility, perpetual quietness of heart. It is to have no trouble. It is never to be fretted or vexed, irritable or sore, to wonder at nothing that is done to me, to feel nothing done against me. It is to be at rest when nobody praises me, and when I am blamed or despised. It is to have a blessed home in myself where I can go and shut the door and pray to my Father in secret and be at peace. As in a deep sea of calmness when all around and about is seeming trouble.
Well, we'll see if we have any experience with some of these questions. You may just get a dumb look from some of us. But we'll see. Go ahead.
The first question here says that the fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, and eighth step requires me to push past my fear and uncomfortableness for the rest of my life. How do I get comfortable with being uncomfortable? I can understand. If this question, I'm going to guess, was probably written in the middle of the study while we were in the midst of the work, because I could see how in the middle of this conversation you could get the feeling that what I'm going to end up with my life in Alcoholics Anonymous is an uncomfortable, challenged, out of my set, just kind of this feeling. Because that's what it might feel like while we're talking about step four and five. If the end result of Alcoholics Anonymous was that I was uncomfortable all the time, I would drink again. I'm not a guy that has the ability to sit uncomfortable. I'm the short fuse guy. If I can't find happiness, peace, serenity, and joy in Alcoholics Anonymous, I will drink again. So I will tell you that although there are some difficult things that I have to walk through in the process of Alcoholics Anonymous and the uncovering, discarding of a discovery that it takes for me to find God, that the end result of active work in Alcoholics Anonymous is that most of the time, I'm very comfortable in my own skin. Most of the time, this is a very happy and comfortable life.
Well, I think it takes years of action to start to trust this. Here's a really good question. How do you keep your ego in check while being circuit speakers? Well, let me tell you something. This kills people. This has the potential to feed everything that should be starved. And some people get into this and then they don't do the rest of AA. They just become speakers and it starves everything that should be fed. I have several people, my sponsor being primary, in my life that watch me, and that if I start going too much down that road, they're on me about that. One of the things that allows me to, it's I won't tell you, it doesn't affect my ego from time to time, but I have commitments in Vegas that I do during the week. I have a home group. My home group knows that they're my home group. My sponsor knows he's my sponsor. I'm accountable to him. He's harsh at times with me. I'm grateful for that. I go to a meeting every week. I try to give two a week. There have been times I did more in a treatment center where I'm not a big shot circuit speaker. I'm the guy that's interfering with their nap. Right. You know what I'm saying? That's good. That's a nice thing. If you come to Las Vegas on a Monday night, you can come to my home group about 45 minutes to an hour early, and you will see me at the door, and I'm greeting people. And if you come to the Tuesday night meeting, you come early. I'll be one of the guys setting the chairs up and helping with the food. And that's the real important stuff in AA. This is fluff. I try not to think of this as like there's some kind of hierarchy of service. This is glorified cleaning the bathrooms at your home group. There is no hierarchy of service. If you're serious about being a servant, then you just say yes to whatever AA asks you to do. If a guy calls you on the phone from Alcoholics Anonymous and asks you to hear his fifth step, I just finished my fourth step, you say yes. If a guy needs a ride, you try to get him a ride or give him a ride, yes. It's just yes. This is just another yes. It's not special yes. There's no hierarchy here. I don't know. It's a tough thing. If it started to really consume me, I know people in AA that they don't do anything in AA except talk. That means that every meeting they go to, all they listen to is an idiot. Right? See, I'll go to my home group tomorrow night, and I'll hear someone. I go there to listen. It's a speaker meeting, and I go there to listen. Because I got to do that. I got to be one of you guys. This can kill you. It's very dangerous stuff.
You know, the big thing that I think it's important to remember about people that come to the microphone in Alcoholics Anonymous is to remember what our gift really is. Because it's not a gift of great insight. It's not a gift of knowing more about sobriety or being better AA members. There are people in this room that are far more connected to God than I am. There are people in this room that are better AA members than I am, that help more people than I help. The only gift that I have is God has given me the ability to string words together and make them sound pretty in sentences. It is the gift of being the class clown. Now God puts that to some good use, combined with active work in Alcoholics Anonymous and obviously some insight that comes with that. But the real gift is the gift of communication. And I think that understanding that is the thing that makes a speaker in AA and not some kind of spiritual mastery or insight, that what makes a speaker is the gift of communication, I think lets you understand what it is that Bob and I do. There are people in the room that are better spiritual examples and better AA members than I would ever aspire to be. And that's humbling. That's humbling. This question says, what are your feelings about the acceptance of drug addicts at AA meetings? Is it the place of fellow AA members to discount what they have to share, especially if they get more from AA than NA? It's a question that can be loaded with controversy, can it? Right? I will guarantee that in this room right now, this is like the sexual question. There are opinions, varied opinions running to extremes, perhaps absurd extremes. I'll guarantee this. Everybody in the room has an opinion about this. They don't all agree. but everybody has an opinion and everybody feels incredibly strongly about that opinion. Alcoholics Anonymous is about recovery from alcoholism. Alcoholism is the disease that I suffer from. I think that identification with alcoholics and Alcoholics Anonymous and our singleness and purpose is important. I'm familiar with the story of the Washingtonians. And if you're not familiar with the story of the Washingtonians, it would be great for you to become familiar with the story of the Washingtonians. They were a group much like Alcoholics Anonymous that started in the 1800s, bunch of guys that were alcoholics that were helping each other, and they actually grew faster than we did. They looked like the trajectory these guys were on as far as growth was far faster than us. And they did this, you know, Wilson had the advantage of the radio and newspaper and telephone. I mean, you think about the handicap that they had in 1930s compared to today when we have email and internet. Well, these guys in the Washingtonians, they didn't even have the motor car back then. It was the Pony Express is how you got the message around. And these guys grew faster than AA. And they got off the track of being focused only on treatment of alcoholism. And they started to get involved in slavery, and they started to get involved in abolition. They started to get involved in the temperance movement. They started to get involved in different political ideas. And the problem is that all of a sudden you got all these guys in the room that are hanging out together for recovery but have other things that they're focused on, and they start to argue and they get dissension and they lose their spiritual focus and they fell apart. And they went from 150,000 to none in an incredibly short amount of time. And so our singleness of purpose is very important. I have a personal experience that I'll share with you. When I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, if you would have asked me to put on a scale the amount of alcohol I did compared to the amount of drugs that I did, I would have told you that I believed that the scale would have tipped heavily towards drugs. I would have told you that most of what I did was drugs, and I did obviously drink plenty, but I didn't do as much alcohol as I did drugs. And that sometimes when people would begin these rigid singleness of purpose talks, that it would make me feel comfortable and like I didn't belong in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't like it at all. And it scared me because Alcoholics Anonymous was the only place I found recovery, and I wanted to be sober so desperately, and I needed this way of life. But I would sometimes be made to feel uncomfortable by a rigid, "You don't belong here, kid. You should go somewhere else," kind of a conversation that nobody ever had with me, right? ever. But that when some guy was sharing at a meeting, I would think that he was sharing at me, and I would take it personally, even though it wasn't directed at me. And I would then climb on the same high horse that I thought he was climbing on, and I would want to argue this point. Alcoholics do drugs. It's very rare today that you will find somebody of, say, my dad's generation. My dad's generation, he was a pre-60s baby. My dad's generation, there were a lot of people that drank and never did any drugs. It would be very difficult, I think, to find someone. They exist. There's probably one or two guys here today, but it's very difficult to find somebody that only drank and never did any drugs. It's a funny deal. I would tell you that I was more of a drug addict than an alcoholic. And then I had an experience in the last couple of years. I had two guys from my past. One guy found me on the internet from some sales training stuff that I had done for a company, and he found me and he called me up, and when I called him back, he answers the phone, and he was my boss for a long time. And when I worked for him, I would have told you that I drank occasionally, but I was really bad with the cocaine. And when he answered the phone, he knew it was me, and he said, "Is this Sheldon? Sheldon, I can handle my liquor, Fetty." His perception of me when I worked for him was that I was a drunk. My perception of me when I worked for him was that I was a cocaine addict. When I came out here to Philadelphia and I was posting on Facebook that I was in Philadelphia an awful lot, the guy who helped me in QVC, this guy was, he got relegated to my handler. What he really was the sales rep that was selling the product to QVC, a very important job. What he became was the guy that held my hand to make sure I showed up when it was time to go on air. Right? He was my babysitter. He'd tuck my shirt in, straighten my tie, spray me with cologne, and throw me in front of the camera is what I relegated this poor guy to. And I'd already made amends to this guy years before, and he saw I was in Philadelphia, and he wanted to see me. And we went and talked. And this wasn't an amends conversation because the amends had already been made. So it was more of a free exchange about laughing about the history. And he told me that these guys had a bet going that they thought I'd have about 6 or 8 months to live. What they told him his job was to keep me alive as long as possible to make them a bunch of money because I was making them a bunch of money. And his job was to keep me alive. And I said, yeah, I was doing a lot of drugs back then. He said, yeah, not really. You were drinking like you were a bad alcoholic. And that wasn't my recollection of the way that it was at the time. So I don't know if it's because the drugs had panache or they were illegal or there was always more. You know, you could walk into a liquor store and buy a bottle, but you got to hook up with Chewy to get it back. So I don't know why my perception was different with how much activity was spent drinking and doing drugs. But I'm clearly a drinker, clearly an alcoholic that did some drugs as well. I, though, come down a little bit on a controversial point. And I would tell you the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous says that we don't try and diagnose anyone with alcoholism, which means that we shouldn't try and diagnose anybody to say they don't have it either. I think that you are wrong when you say to someone you might be a drunk, and you're equally wrong when you say to someone, you know, based on your story, you might want to go to NA or CA or a different fellowship because, boy, I'm going to diagnose you as not an alcoholic. Because I'm glad nobody did that to me, because I'm a guy that showed up here, an addict, learned he had alcoholism, and found recovery. So I just caution us to stay out of the controversy. And I think if you're not an alcoholic, you'll get bored here quick enough, and you'll fall away of your own volition. Bob?
Most of us have been unwilling to admit we were real alcoholics. By every form of experimentation and self-deception, we try to prove ourselves exceptions to the rule and therefore non-alcoholic. Wilson says something in the pamphlet, Problems Other Than Alcohol, and he's not talking to the new people. He's not telling them that they shouldn't be. He's not saying that at all. What he says is talking to us old-timers. And he's saying to us, he said, you should not try to make a non-alcoholic into an alcoholic because you like them. And I've done that. I had a guy at detox, this is a long time ago, probably 20 years ago or so. He came up to me after the meeting and he said, my God, I really enjoyed what you shared. I've never identified more with anyone. And I just knew instantly this is a bright guy. And then he said, he said, would you sponsor me? And he has good taste. And I started to, I was just beginning to learn the interviewing process that you do, you know, and I was talking to the guy. And so I said to him, are you an alcoholic? And he said, no, I'm not. I don't drink at all. I don't even like to drink. I don't like to drink at all. He said, I do coke. And I got in trouble with coke. And I said, but you're probably an alcoholic. He said, I don't know. I've never really liked alcohol. I never drank it. I don't like the feel. I don't like any of it. I said, but if you did drink it, you probably would be an alcoholic. Because this guy, I liked it. I wanted this guy in my home group, right? Because he knew, unlike the other members, what a great person I was. And so I did what Wilson said not to do. Well, after a couple years, it came out he wasn't an alcoholic and he could actually drink. I was down right before my 30th AA birthday, so this little six and a half years ago, I guess. I was in Tucson And I was doing a workshop like we're doing this with a guy named Scott. And I started the first session off with the doctor's opinion. And a woman came up to me and she showed me before the meeting started, showed me her 30-year chip. And she had a row of girls she sponsored in the room. And she said to me after the first session, she said, "I don't have that thing you're talking about." And I said, what do you mean? She said, "That allergic reaction to alcohol, a phenomenon of craving." Well, she's 30. She showed me a 30-year chip, so I know how it is. Well, a lot of us don't get it. We think we drink as a result of the craving. We think it's our idea because it uses our own mind against us. And it had been 30 years. And I said to her, "Well, it's been 30 years. How do you know? You just don't remember, probably." And she goes like this. She looks to the left, and then she looks to the right. She goes, "Well, actually, I have a drink or two once in a while." And then she saw my face, and she went, "But I don't get drunk. It's just one drink, two drinks sometimes. Once in a while, I don't get drunk." And I said to her, "You drunk?" She said, "Yeah." I said, "Did it bother you to take a 30-year chip?" She said, "Well, yeah, a little bit, but I don't get drunk." And I talked to her. She never was an alcoholic. But she came, her husband was an alcoholic, and he passed away many years ago, and he had taken her to an Al-Anon meeting. She didn't really like Al-Anon. She came into an AA meeting and really liked AA, which is, if you're at Al-Anon, this is like a room full of your drug of choice. I mean, that shouldn't be surprising, really. And here's what she did. Here's how she concluded that she was an alcoholic. She identified with the emotions and concluded, "Since I feel, even though I don't have a problem with alcohol and never will and never did," she concluded, "since she felt like some of us, that she must have alcoholism." And that's a common experience. Sometimes the only difference internally between an alcoholic and someone who suffered from alcoholism from the family is the allergy. But the allergy is important. And the reason it's important, because if you don't have the allergy, and what potentially would, this is frightening to me, is that 20 years from now, if we open the doors wide for everybody with all kinds of problems, then what could potentially happen is that we could have a fellowship where maybe a significant portion of the people here can drink successfully and really can without ever having a problem, because we really are the minority. And that makes Alcoholics Anonymous a place that I can't trust what I hear here. And I can't trust this. So you can have a lot of other problems. You can have a gambling problem. You can have a problem with cocaine, with heroin, with pills. You can have a problem with pornography. You can have a problem with spending. You can be, as Clancy says, "We don't even care if you choke little baby chickens' necks. We don't care what other problems you have. But it's important that you should have alcoholism." Not something that's all, that's, we don't want, it's not like something that's like alcoholism. You should have alcoholism. You can have all the other stuff too. That's fine. Matter of fact, I don't know anybody that comes here and their problem is only alcohol. I know people come here and think their problem is only alcohol. And boy, are they in for a rude awakening when they're about 3 years sober. I think that's important. You run into people in AA and you find out that they've been drinking for. We had a guy that chaired the Las Vegas Roundup, and it came out he had to confess to everybody that, I've been chipping around with this stuff for years and never told anybody. What happens? Maybe Sheldon knows this guy. There was a guy, Mike, in our group, Mike G, and he went out after being sober 5 years. And this was really disheartening to me. He got to drink successfully, and he has drank. He never was an alcoholic. He can have one or two drinks. I watched him. I went to see, actually, Sheldon's brother perform in a bar, and he was there, and he had a beer. He probably sat there for a half hour. He'd take a little sip once in a while. I've never done that. I've never done that. And there's a guy that he sponsored. He sponsored four guys, and all of them went out, and I ran in. This is a year and a half, 2 years, 3 years later. I don't know when it was. I was over at Boxwood House, and I ran into this guy, Rhett. And I said, hey, it's good to see you. You want to come over to our home group? I'll pick you up. He doesn't want AA because his exposure to AA is the primary person, his sponsor that he trusted wasn't even an alcoholic, so he doesn't trust us anymore. You know? And I thought... That's what I think. That's tragic, actually. Because we don't care if you have other problems. Welcome. I love what Scott Redmond used to say. He says, if you're a drug addict, welcome. We hope you catch alcoholism here. You can be the Bigfoot of drug fiends. It's all right. Just catch alcoholism here, because when you catch it, the steps make sense. If you don't catch it and you're treating some symptomatic thing, the steps don't make sense. They don't work. Anyway, I've got on a rant with that. This, oh, I get it. Okay.
I stepped off the soapbox.
Yeah, I did.
I'll pay for that.
I like the soapbox because it's the view. You're higher up and you look down on everybody. Yeah. I just, How do you deal with the death of a sponsee, their family, friends, relationships with them? Any thoughts? I've had this a lot. People die. People die of this disease. It's a lot. One of the earlier guys that I sponsored over my first 2 years, I guess, was a guy named Andy Henry. And Andy and I were very, very close. You know that kind of intimacy that you have when you sit in a Denny's with a guy for hours after meetings and you talk about your whole life, right? And we were cut very much from the same cloth. And Andy had a bad case of alcoholism, and I didn't. I wasn't into this. I was doing a rudimentary thing with the steps. I was staying sober basically on a lot of activities. A lot of 12-step work, a lot of H&I, a lot of committees, and going to probably 15, 20 meetings a week. And Andy calls me up one night, and he'd been to two meetings that day. I said, did you pray? He said, yeah, I asked God for help. And he's calling me, and he says, I have the obsession to drink. And I don't know what to tell him. I'm not properly armed with this thing yet. And I just said, well, go to another meeting. And there was a late night meeting at the Duffy's at 10:15. He went to that meeting and evidently came out of the meeting. The obsession hadn't gone away. He went out and he got drunk. He came to the next morning. He got on his Kawasaki 1100 motorcycle, went out the old Lancaster Pike and waited for a tractor trailer truck coming 70 miles an hour the opposite way. And he painted himself on the front at 120 miles an hour. He hit a truck coming 70 the opposite direction and literally vaporized himself on the front of that truck. And I went to his funeral services down in Lancaster. Several of us from AA went down there. And I was sitting in that chapel, and it just devastated me because I really loved this guy. And I knew two things. I knew that I didn't kill him. But I also knew that I didn't have what he needed either. You can't transmit something you haven't got. And Andy was one of the major factors that drove me into the big book. At a time when nobody was reading this book, really, and studying this book, he drove me in there because I thought, I better find something here because I can't stop helping people because it's the only thing I've found that relieved me of my depressive nature. But yet I don't want to be in another chapel like this, knowing that I shortchanged a guy, not out of malice, but out of ignorance and lack of experience, and I better get the experience to be helpful to these guys. And Andy changed my life, and I spent some time with his dad, his His dad was such a nice guy. He loved Andy. He was a bit of an enabler. It's been about 8 years now since I've talked to his dad. His dad would call me from time to time. Because sometimes you can't, maybe you just have to try to be there for the family, you know. Over the years, I've gone to a couple funeral services of people in AA who drank again or committed suicide or whatever. I have a hard time going to them. If you're a sober member and you die, I'm there. I mean, I think it's a great celebration of your life. But I have a hard time because what happens in this, we all in our hearts have a need to love. And so if there was someone who drank again or committed suicide and you go to their service, there's a tendency to fabricate an image of the person as a great AA member, which really makes me feel conflicted, because if that's true, then AA doesn't work, right? And I was at Frank Madden, who committed suicide at 23 and a half years sober, and he'd been on pills. And everybody was memorializing him as such an amazing example of Alcoholics Anonymous. And his ex-wife, Minnie, got up and she said, "That's a bunch of crap. He was a terrible example of Alcoholics Anonymous, or else he wouldn't be in this spot." Right? See, and that's why I have a hard time going to those kind of services, because it's the tendency to memorialize someone. And I understand it's not out of malice. It's out of love. And they miss them. I get it, but I believe AA works. I believe we can fail AA, but I don't believe AA can fail us. So I have a hard time going in here, and that, even though I have to tell myself it's good intention, they care, etc. But I don't think those people are a good example of AA. I don't think they're bad people. But I don't think it's a good... I think they miss something here. And we all can miss something here. It doesn't make them a bad person. Anyway, that's my two cents.
They used to say when I used to hear a lot when I got sober, you'd hear of people dying of alcoholism. And people would say, you know, some people have to die so the rest of us can live. I got to tell you, I don't think that's true. Yeah. I don't think anybody has to die. I really don't. I agree with Bob. I think Alcoholics Anonymous works. I think that if we do what we do, I've lost a lot, not a lot of guys, but a handful of guys, two or three guys that I have tried to sponsor have passed away. A couple of members of my home group have passed away. Two guys I know relatively closely have committed suicide. And the one thing I will tell you about all of them is that I wasn't surprised. Not one time did I go, really? I always went, But this is a conversation that stays in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous. How do you deal with their family, their friends, their loved ones that aren't in AA? You tell them they were great people, that you loved them. Mm-hmm. You tell them you're going to miss them. You're as kind to them as you can be. Try to lessen their pain as much as possible. You certainly don't tell them what we know, which is that it was kind of their fault, and if they'd have made different decisions, things would be different. You don't tell them that. You don't tell them that. You just be kind and you love them. This is like the spiritual raffle. Okay. Bob says he's going to leave us now and go hide because he's afraid of the next few. No, he's. I'll be back in half of 1 second. Do you fire a sponsee, or do you just take a step back until he is willing? It's a great question. That's a great question. I've never fired a sponsee. I've never told a sponsee that I can't work with them anymore. Maybe to my detriment. I mean, remember, I just told you that I've had a couple of guys that I sponsored that have died of alcoholism and have killed themselves. So maybe if I would have said to them some point on their journey, that I can't work with them, then perhaps I would have changed their trajectory. I don't know. I don't see it anywhere in our literature where it suggests, though, that I would fire a guy. It does say on page 96 that if a guy doesn't want what you have to offer, that you don't chase him. And that's typically the way that I am with guys that I sponsor. If somebody asks me to sponsor them, I invariably say yes. That's the question I'm asking. Mm-hmm. And I will meet them at their place of willingness is what I will tell guys. What I will tell guys is, look, man, if you call me every day, I'll answer the phone every day. If you meet me at the home group every time I'm there, I will make time out of my schedule and I will find time to meet with you. Like everybody else, I'm a busy guy, but God has always provided me with both the energy and the time that I have needed to work with somebody who is eager and willing to accept what it is that I have to offer. But if you call me once every 3 weeks, I may not answer the phone on that once in 3 weeks phone call because I have other people that I'm trying to help and work with. If you don't show up to the home group and you're not actively going to the places where you know I'm going to be, I may say if I have, you know, sponsee number one who is doing all the stuff that I'm doing and is following the direction I'm giving him, and sponsee number two that's kind of half-heartedly putting in the effort, and I've got a three-hour window and they both ask for that window, who do you think I'm going to give that time to? I'm going to give that time to the guy that's more actively involved and more eagerly pursuing our way of life, because our way of life is a way of life that needs to be pursued. But I have never... Now, I've hinted to guys. I told a guy one time who kept getting drunk. He came back to me and asked me to sponsor him again. And I said to him, you know, if I took my car to a mechanic to get it repaired, and every time it left the shop, it broke down again right away afterwards, I might find a different mechanic to take my car to. You know, I mean, boy, I may not be transmitting the message the way you need to hear it. So I will make suggestions like that, but I don't think that I have, I don't think it's up to me to tell God's kids or to tell God which ones of his kids I'm going to help and which ones I'm not going to help. Bob?
You don't sponsor people for 36 years and not look back and have regrets. It's not going to happen. But we learn from our mistakes, and if you learn from your mistakes and you take what you should from that experience, you haven't missed taking from that experience, and you grow and change. I've had guys that I've fired. There's been a call. I haven't fired many guys over the years. I've had guys I fired later. I thought, that was probably not the right thing to do. But I'd listened to some hardliners, you know, and I thought that it seemed like it might have been the right thing to do. And later I looked back and with some regret. There have been a couple guys that I think I should have fired. The reason I look back and I've helped them perpetrate an illusion that they had a sponsor when in actuality they didn't.
Yeah.
And here's the bad part about that, is if they die of alcoholism or they go out and drink and they're sitting in a bar, they may tell someone that they did AA. And I even had a sponsor and it didn't, AA didn't work. When I've helped them believe that they were doing AA when in actuality they're not. So I have what I think of as the come to Jesus talk with them. I won't fire them, but I got to tell you the truth. You're not doing this. So that if you drink again, you're going to know that AA didn't fail you, that you failed it. You're not doing this thing. Yeah. Doesn't make you a bad guy, but you're not doing this thing. And if you keep putting it in their face that they're not doing this thing, one of two things is going to happen. They're going to be so aggravated by the conversation, they're going to start doing more, or they're going to quit you. But either way, your problem is solved. Right? And I think it's a lot of it's like that. You don't have to fire someone. You just have to, you just have to keep talking about the principles and talking about the principles, and eventually they're going to go somewhere else, or they're going to start lining up with what we do here. But there's a question. So how do you? Oh, this is a good. How do you? This is a common. I've had this question 100 times at least. How do you keep balance? And then he has a list of sponsor, wife, mother, manager, treasurer, daughter, etc., etc. One of the things that happens to all of us, if you start to practice these principles in all your affairs, you're going to end up with a big life. I mean, it's almost unavoidable. That's the good news. The bad news is most of us don't know what to do with it once we got a big life. And everybody's looking for a magic formula of, you know, of how much energy I need to give to my kids and my wife and my business and AA. And I don't think there is a magic formula. I think that you have to be awake. And if you're awake, you will respond to what's going on. It's almost like, imagine all the elements in your life are like a bunch of dogs that you're taking care of. You will, if you're awake, you will listen, you will hear the one that needs to be fed whine, and you'll feed that dog. You feed that dog too much and you ignore the other ones, they'll start to whine, and then you got to feed that one. But there's one dog that you can't, you got to pay attention to every day, because all we have at the best is a daily reprieve, is you got to feed your spiritual condition here. You can't, this is non-compromisable. Now you can diminish your involvement here at times because life isn't giving you a choice, because you got so much going on, but you can't stop. You got to stay in this game. You can't stop doing this. You can't stop treating your spiritual condition. People who do that, we had a mutual friend, Cindy, who had so much on her plate that she quit AA. Mm-hmm. Oh, 3 months almost to the day, she ended up going out again. And she's never been able to get back. That's got to be 10 years.
Maybe. At least 10.
Maybe. And she went from a housewife with a business and kids to losing everything and being on the streets, homeless, turning $5 tricks for another hit off of off the speed pipe. Right? So you can't stop doing this. But everything else is organic. Just pay attention. Pay attention. Don't stop here, but pay attention to all the other. Be responsible. Being responsible is just the ability to respond. Yeah. Life will give, God will give you the cues through life if you're awake, if you're paying attention.
This is a great question, because it comes typically from one of two places. It comes from someone who's an incredibly active member of Alcoholics Anonymous that is struggling with demands on their life that feel like their program is being attacked and feels like their life is in danger. Or it comes from the person who really isn't all that involved in Alcoholics Anonymous and is having a great time at work and a great time running around with members of the opposite sex or whatever their deal is, and they're having a great time, and they're afraid that AA is going to get in the way of their fun. So it's a difficult question to answer unless you know who you're talking to. So let me tell you, if you're the person who's not, you know, is doing one or two meetings a week and I'm trying to find balance in my life, I hope you stay sober, because it's a difficult place to come from. So but I want to answer the question from my personal experience. I'm a guy that when I got sober was doing 7 to 10 meetings a week, every week. I did everything. I bought into the statement that you can't say no to an AA request. And once you become the guy that doesn't say no to an AA request, the AA requesters start requesting, because they get sick of being told no. Right? And so they've got your phone number, and yours is the one they call, because Sheldon will do it, right? And so I become this guy, and I love it. And it was beautiful for me. I created a foundation in Alcoholics Anonymous that was irreplaceable. I got this big job, and I'm working at this big job, and there, because of my activity in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have turned into the kind of person they want to promote, and they're promoting me. And so now the job is getting more demanding, and I fall in love with an AA member, and we start a family, and she's a beautiful woman, and we have a kid, and I've got a son, and now I've got this big life. I've got this 7 to 10 meeting a week AA life. I've got a 50 or 60 hour a week work week, and I've got this young family that, I want to be a participant in. And, there isn't enough time in the day for me to do all that stuff. And, I won't give up the 7 to 10 meetings a week and the intense participation in Alcoholics Anonymous. I would find myself in arguments with my wife, and I would say the silliest things to her. I would say, "You don't want me to go to a meeting every single day and do all this work. You're trying to kill me. I will die if you put these demands on me." LaBob, with all my heart, my hero in Alcoholics Anonymous, single guy, retired, married guy with a job. I try to follow a single retired guy around, I'll be divorced and unemployed. It's just the nature of the way that will be. I don't want to be divorced and unemployed. My wife is fighting with me. I'm never home. I'm never with my son. I get home from work at 6 o'clock. Throw some food down. We get out of the house for a 7 o'clock meeting. I get home after he's gone to bed. When I'm home with her, I'm home with her only long enough for her to tell me about the problems that she's had in her day. There is no time for intimacy because I'm not there long enough to get beyond the "you left your shoes in the middle of the living room." Parker's got a bad cough. There's a doctor's appointment on Tuesday. I'll text you later to tell you how the appointment went. We don't have any time to get beyond that. I'm having an argument with my wife about this, and I was speaking a lot more at the time. Now I'll only leave town maybe once a month. Our agreement is 8 times a year, which means it becomes 10 to 14 because I'm not good at sticking to agreements, right? So I'll only leave. By the time I was going out twice a month, and so even on the weekends when I was off, I wasn't home. And I started to pray to God, and I tell you, the funniest thing happened to me. I got a picture in my mind. In my dream, it wasn't really dreaming. I was like half awake, but this picture that came to me, it was Judgment Day, which is bizarre because I don't have a faith that has a Judgment Day. But it was your faith, my life, Judgment Day. And God and I are sitting looking at movies of my life. And watching the movie of my life, there was a picture of me sitting with a guy going through the steps. And my chest puffed up. Because I knew God was showing me the great work that I had done. And I just felt so good about this judgment that I knew I was being judged well. And then it was like a cinematic moment like you'd see in a Hollywood movie. I remember this clear as if I could see it right now. The camera panned out. And sitting up in the corner was my son playing with some toys by himself. And I got the message. I have to be an active everyday member of Alcoholics Anonymous. There is nobody, and don't misunderstand this, because there is nobody that is in my life that would not tell you my primary purpose is Alcoholics Anonymous. Sponsor a lot of guys. I'm involved in my home group. I'm at the halfway house. I'm doing Alcoholics Anonymous on an everyday basis. But I got the message that I don't have to sponsor everybody. I don't have to do every commitment. Somebody else can do some of that work in AA. Because only I can be that little boy's dad. That was a gift from God. That is a job that God gave me to do. I am her husband also. I am their employee also. I am his father also. Alcoholics Anonymous teaches me that my primary purpose is to help other alcoholics. There is an implication in that, that it is not my only purpose, just my primary purpose. I have something more than my primary purpose, and that's my real purpose. And that's to fit myself to be of maximum usefulness to God and the people about me. Not just in Alcoholics Anonymous, but outside of Alcoholics Anonymous. Very difficult thing to say without being clear enough to the fundamentalists in the room that I am an everyday member of AA, but that this is a real life situation where the single man or the guy, we judge the people with families. Is there, we, if in the 12 and 12, Bill talks about, on page 101, I think it is, Wilson talks about, if you do Alcoholics Anonymous like your life depends on it, if you're an everyday member of AA, then you will get a beautiful family situation and you'll get to raise your kids and be a husband and a father or a wife and a mother. And then he mentions as a consolation prize that you'll get to be the secretary of the meeting. You'll get to stack the chairs. You'll get to be on your GSR, your GSO committee. He mentions that as if, don't worry if you don't get all the blessings that are available to you in Alcoholics Anonymous and you don't re-enter life. It almost like that's a consolation prize. So is it a battle? Is there a push and a pull? Or do you feel like a piece of taffy? Yes. Is treatment of your alcoholism most important and paramount? Yes, because you'll lose everything else if you don't treat your alcoholism. But is part of serving God, taking care of your family obligations, helping to raise your children, being a good husband, father, child, friend, and employee? Yes, those are all part of it too. No, I already did that one. Oh, my. Regarding step nine, when it comes to debts and money given to us in financial hardship and sober, we discuss paying back money to parents, but what if our boyfriends or girlfriends financially got us out of a jam and told us we didn't have to pay them back? Should we pay anyway? Does this paradigm shift only when married and money is shared? I don't know, does it? I mean, if I'm sober and I'm in a relationship with someone and our money is commingled. It depends. I would say when I'm drinking and my parents let me off the hook, the only reason that we harp on the fact that your parents and the people when you were drinking that let you off the hook, and you shouldn't let yourself be let off the hook by that, is because every parent, to ask the Al-Anons, the only thing they want is for us to be okay. And they are so delighted at the prospect we might be okay, they'll do anything to help us be okay. And if letting you off the 10 grand you ripped them off will somehow alleviate some pressure from you and help you maybe have a better shot at being okay, God, they don't care. They'd pay another 10 grand if it would help you be okay. So that's why we talk about that, because they're going to let you off the hook no matter what, and you can't be let off the hook. Somebody when you're sober, that you're in a relationship with, not under duress, because that's how my dad gave me money, was under duress. Not under duress wants to help you? I don't know if that is if they don't want the money, if they want to help you because they love you. In fact, if a guy came to me and said, my girlfriend needs to borrow $1,000, should I lend it to her? I would say, absolutely not. Give it to her. And if she gives it back to you, God bless you. Because you know what? The thing that causes problems, typically in relationships, is that kind of stuff anyway. So I tell guys, don't lend anybody any money in AA or out of AA to your family members. If you can afford to give it to them, give it to them. No strings attached. It just protects the relationship better.
Isn't there a harms list in the fourth step? I don't think so. I know people that do. In the sexual inventory, contained within the sexual inventory, it talks about a list of the people we'd harmed in the sexual inventory. Now, some people have extrapolated that out as a separate list. And I understand their thinking, because they can't find where else to put. There are people that it's hard to see where you've harmed them. Like maybe someone you've You've ripped them off. You don't resent them. They have no idea that you're the one that got the money, so you don't even have any fear there that you're aware of. And so you don't know where to put it, and yet they have to be, it has to be mended. So they, people create a separate list of people who they've harmed that don't fit in any of those others. But here's my experience that I got this after I'd been sober a long time. And I didn't get this when I was new. Is that every time I've ever harmed someone, there is a fear involved. A fear of karmatic retribution, a fear of being judged in the eyes of God, a fear of them finding out it was me. And so I have tried to encourage the people that I sponsor to take those and find where can they fit? Or, you know, because if it's bugging you, there's an anxiousness about that, which is one of the 100 forms of fear. So would it fit on your fear list? These secrets that you are afraid of disclosure, these people you've hurt, that you maybe feel like maybe, you know, God knows that I did that. You know, that little bit of anxiousness. And in my experience, I found that every single one of those would fit usually on my fear inventory. But that's a level of honesty that you don't get in your first couple years to be able to identify the fear. Most of us can't identify fear when we first get here. We can see anger, but we can't see fear for a while.
Can you please clarify, to sum up sex, when to yield would mean heartache? That section of the book is talking about what if I am obsessed or driven, or I want to get in a relationship that I shouldn't be in, I want to have some sexual misconduct or conduct that I should or shouldn't have. I also like to refer to that when I'm talking to guys about other things they struggle with, and I'm taking a little bit of a poetic or literary license, because the page earlier it says we treat sex as we would any other problem. So I like to talk about maybe it's gambling, maybe you have an obsession to gamble and you can't seem to stop gambling, or maybe it's something like smoking and you can't, or maybe it's going to spending money, or whatever it might be, whatever the thing is that is making you nuts, causing you problem in your life, self-destructive behavior, whatever the maybe it's that you fly off the handle at your wife too quickly or your husband too quickly, maybe it's anger, whatever it is of the main character defects that is coming up in you and is causing you problems in your life. When I used to read that, I read it wrong. When it says to yield would create heartache, for some reason the way I read it was I thought it says to throw yourself the harder into helping new people. So in other words, to get out of self, to become other-centered. What's happening is that I am consumed with one of the manifestations of self. Is what's going on with me. The reason that I am driven to do behavior that I don't want to do is because one of the forms of self is being satisfied by that behavior. And so I'm trapped in self-obsession. And so it suggests that I help somebody else in order to get relief from that. And the way I read it was that I do that because if I participate in the behavior, it will cause me heartache. So you're better off going to help somebody else. Don't sleep with that girl because, you know, it's going to be a mess. Either, you know, she's got a boyfriend, you've got a girlfriend. You, something's bad's going to come of it. You have a sense of that. You shouldn't do it. Don't go and gamble. You never seem to win. Last time you gambled the rent money, you had to, this person that asked the other question had to borrow the money to pay the rent from their girlfriend. It's really, and then you got to ask a question of some speaker from out of town that you don't know. It's just going to be a difficult situation. So it's probably better that you don't go gamble, because if you go gamble, it will cause heartache. And so I imagined that the heartache it would cause would be the thing that happens to me that makes me regret doing the behavior. But that's not what it says. It says we do this because to yield, to stop, to not do the behavior would cause heartache. For me to not do the thing that I want to do is what causes me the discomfort. And that discomfort is what helping new people will help me to be alleviated of. It will help me to not do the behavior. Because it is in doing the behavior feels good at first. That's why I keep doing the behavior. Because I like it. Right? It's maybe later it causes me problems that I don't want and I resent the problems that come from the behavior. Isn't that really what I resent, not the behavior itself? So in Alcoholics Anonymous we say, do the next right thing. Not the next easy thing. If it was do the next easy thing, I wouldn't need a sponsor. It's do the next right thing, which sometimes is difficult. Sometimes yielding causes heartache. And so we take unselfish acts of working with other people to help relieve us from the bondage of self.
Or film it and put it on the internet.
$1.99 a minute, right?
Yeah, right.
How do you forgive and make amends to someone who is dead? In the big book, it says some people cannot be seen, so we write them an honest letter. I've done that with my grandfather. I suggest to guys to get the sense of where that person's spirit might be found. Might be the gravesite. It might be your dad's favorite fishing hole. It might be a place that he used to live or work. And you take the letter there wherever you get the greatest sense of his or her or their spirit. And you read the letter there and you let the emotions do what they're going to do. And often, matter of fact, in my experience, you will get closure. That the ghosts that haunt you of the memories of that person and what was unresolved will get resolved. That kind of makes a sense. If we are all but one, then it's possible to connect there with that person's spirit.
You spoke of ego. How do we
carry the message?
How do we carry the message of recovery without ego? Judgment, but love, caring and compassion. How do we carry the message without ego? I think I'm struggling to come with an answer for that because when I'm with a guy one-on-one and we're talking about recovery and I'm sharing this experience, I fall in love with these guys. In fact, the only time that I think I am truly free of ego and of self is when I'm sitting with a guy going through the book and talking about this stuff. It is the time of my life, I think, where I have to least worry about that. Now, stood here at a podium, there is much danger of ego being a problem. Bob and I talked about how we deal with that already at length. But as far as one-on-one with a guy, I think that that is the time that I fall in love with a guy, and that it is the time that I personally find myself least likely to have my ego engaged. Bob?
You're never going to be free. There's only one way I know of that possibly would free you 100% from ego, and that's a full frontal lobotomy. And in your vegetative state, you will be egoless, I imagine. But I think it would grow back, you know? I just don't you think, wouldn't it grow back? You just go from
My frontal lobotomy is better than your frontal lobotomy.
Yeah, right. It would grow back. So, a guy told me when I was new, he said, stand in front of the mirror naked. And whatever you see there, if you can't kill it, you better learn to live with it. And I think you just have to accept that we're always going to have ego. And it's always going to clamor at us. But like Sheldon said, I am the most free of it when I'm not thinking about me and I'm trying to care about somebody else. It is in the other-centered altruistic actions of Alcoholics Anonymous that we seem to be relieved of the bondage of self. Not once and for all, but intermittently as we take those actions. So that's why we stay engaged here.
We've kind of come to the end of the time of our last session. I just want to express to you guys my gratitude for your attentiveness, love, and kindness this weekend. This has been a wonderful experience for me. I'm very grateful to each and every one of you. Thank you for letting me come and spend the weekend with you.